The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Kevin McCullough. Great to be with you. This week, Dr. Gina Loudon joins us for a look at the latest in politics.
We take so much of what the media says seriously when it's just an absolute eyeball and ear grab for audience.
A teacher was fired for refusing to call a girl a boy.
As someone once said, you know, you will be made to comply. That is what this is about, despite folks who might have religious objections.
And as the holiday season brings joy to most, it brings depression to others.
Many Christians are ashamed they're depressed. They believe that only good Christians are happy and contented Christians, and that somehow they failed God. But nothing could really be further from the truth when we believe that.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Kevin McCullough, coming to you from my home station in New York City. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon at AM 570 The Mission and AM 970 The Answer. If you were to only read the mainstream media accounts of President Trump, you'd be sure he's going to be impeached, then on to prison. But that talk started at the end of January 2017 when he took over the job of president and continues unabated today. Dr. Gina Loudon, author of the book Mad Politics, is a media advisor for President Trump, and I spoke with her on my program earlier this week prior to the sentencing of Michael Cohen, who was given 3 years in prison for a cluster of campaign finance violations. Cohen, you'll remember, was Trump's lawyer. Gina joined my program on AM 970 The Answer in New York City. This weekend, within seconds of opening every national talk show on Sunday, all of the national shows were using the words indictment and he's not going to serve out his term. And there's just this frothy, seething desire to see this man go to jail. I can't quite comprehend it, Dr. Gina, but what's your reaction to it?
Well, I mean, it's... This is so simple to me when I look at it under the template of clickbait media. And I wrote so much about this in my book, Mad Politics, Kevin,
yes, you
because
did.
I think that we overlook it and we take so much of what the media says seriously when it's just an absolute eyeball and ear grab for audience. And so, you know, you have the Never Trump media out there and that's all they have. You know, again, I watch the president as I see these storms, these little media storms, you know, percolate, and I watch him, and he's as chill as ever. He's having a great time. He loves being America's president. He knows how solid his base is, and he is largely unconcerned. What he doesn't want is people going to jail wrongly, and I think we'll see some pardons at some point based upon what he sees as a complete lack of justice in this witch hunt. But I don't believe the president is concerned. He knows exactly what he did. He had no part. I was around for a lot of that campaign, Kevin. There was never anything like what the press is trying to insinuate is there.
Right.
But if the press doesn't have something, Kevin, then they have nothing. And if they have nothing, then they have no audience. Their audience is gone. They've been disproven and discredited over and over again by their own doing, by the way.
Right.
And so this is just a desperate grab to hope, to cling on to something that might possibly ever someday mean something. I do believe there was real Russia collusion, of course. I believe, though, it was on the Democrat side of the aisle, and it was Hillary Clinton and Uranium One. And we all know that. And so, you know, the press, again, gleefully jumping on board with whatever shred of possibility they can find.
Yeah. Well, it's very cool to see the president just kind of like water off a duck his way through everything these days. He was at the Army-Navy game, and when they introduced him, oh, my goodness, the roar that the Academy's attendants had, you know, in that. It's obvious that they really love this guy. Because he's no longer sequestering the military, he's building the military, and that's a really good thing. A teacher in a Virginia high school was fired for refusing to call a girl a boy. The girl changed her name. The teacher agreed to call her by it, but when pressed to identify her with a gender pronoun that is not her own, he refused. In this politically correct world, that is firing material. Victoria Cobb is president of the Family Foundation in Virginia. She joined Don Crow on WAVA in nearby Washington, D.C.
Victoria, welcome. Thanks for joining me. And what can you tell us further about this story, how it all began and how it got to this unfortunate end?
Well, thanks so much for having me. It is an unfortunate end, and it is, I think, shocking to Virginians and people all across the country that really believe that we don't check our convictions at the door when we walk into a public place or public service. This is a simple case. Peter Vlaming was a beloved teacher. He had no bad marks on his employment file. He had been there 6.5 years at this West Point High School. And simply trying to abide by his deeply held religious beliefs, that was his offense, and he ended up being fired over it. And I think what folks really need to understand here is that this isn't about coercing a good man to say something that he doesn't believe is true. He was, it's an unfortunate situation that we are in. Those who claim power the loudest want to punish anyone who exercises personally held beliefs that don't align with their agenda, their political agenda. This particular teacher was willing to use the child's preferred name while also being allowed to be guided by his own conscience regarding the use of pronouns. And the school was not able to find that a reasonable solution.
So as you're saying, as I understand what you said, he would refer to her by her given name, but she was having an issue that he wouldn't refer to her as a male.
This is right. I mean, this child had changed their name, and this teacher was willing to go along with the name change because a name is not typically stating something about object reality or stating something that affects someone's religious beliefs. But when it comes down to pronouns, he was unwilling to say something that would violate his faith. And so for that, for the unwillingness to use pronouns, not for the fact that he used incorrect pronouns, for the fact that he was unwilling to use pronouns at all, he was fired.
Now, as I read the piece that you provided on this, you said that the administration insists that by not doing this, he violates school board policy, and they cited the official civil rights policy regarding gender discrimination. But you also noted that they failed to inform him that this federal administrative guidance was rescinded back in 2017.
This was the maybe stunning thing about the hearing. We actually had a situation where the administration handed this teacher a copy of the Obama administration advisory letter as if it was current law and as if it was the reason for the school policy against discrimination, and failed to note that, in fact, this was no longer the advisory level letter from the administration that had actually been rescinded. So not only is their policy bad policy and very vague and unenforceable, it's also premised on something that was so flawed that has now been pulled back.
Toward the end of your piece, you point out there is an agenda behind all of this for enforcing of such ridiculous policies. The goal is really to punish anybody, as you say, who doesn't agree with the ideology of the day, right?
There's no question. Someone once said, you know, you will be made to comply. That is what this is about. This is not about trying to balance the religious freedom interest against the interest of the student. This is simply a board choosing an ideology and choosing to force 100% compliance with that ideology despite folks who might have religious objections. And that should be alarming to everyone if that's the direction that we are headed. And that has been our concern with any of these policies that invoke gender identity, sexual orientation issues, because they are so undefined and because their compliance is so unclear. The policy that they claim they are relying on for this dismissal is very vague and very unenforceable. And thankfully, the attorney for this teacher was very clear in outlining that. But that's the trouble when these policies go into place. They have no understanding of religious freedom, and they are not in any way clear as to how they will impact each and every person that runs into these situations.
That's a 5-member school board, along with the superintendent who recommended this policy or this action, and they simply rubber stamped him. I remain puzzled by how these school boards get so polarized. You've got, as you already said, 100-150 people in all outside and in the room protesting this, probably for the most part. And yet, how is it that just a few of these folks can get into these positions of power and then make these decisions that really stick?
Well, there's a couple of things at play here. We have to remember that it is, in fact, the school board itself that chose this policy in the first place, even though it's vague, this adding gender identity into their policy. So we start with they were the initial problem, or this would never be in play. And then you move to the fact that school boards are political bodies, so certainly they come in, I mean, although they don't run as members of a political party per se, but many times they're, you know, they're elected, and they're elected on ideology, and so that comes into play. And then many times they're very hesitant to go against the administration of their school. They want to back the authorities. Unfortunately, they need to understand when the authorities have absolutely abused power and misunderstood the law, and they blew it here. And, you know, we're seeing such a beautiful rise of support from the students. Just this afternoon, they had a huge walkout to support the teacher. They had posters on their locker. These kids, he's beloved. He's not, this is not a case of some teacher that has, you know, disrespected students or in the past students haven't done well with him. This is a teacher that is clear that he's been connected with the students. And there was testimony all throughout the administrative hearing that, in fact, these students would say, yes, he respects everyone. I have never heard him mistreat this individual that's in question. I've never heard him do something to sort of point out this individual that's the student that's in question. And so this is a really unfortunate situation, and I think the school board has gotten it so wrong. And unfortunately, I think they're going to feel the heat from that, not just in the community, but I think we'll see this rise through the courts. I'd be stunned if this does not get appealed.
Well, that's my last question was, I assume there will be an appeal on his part of some sort, and what's his recourse?
Well, it has not been officially announced yet. Everybody kind of takes time to regroup after these kind of things. But I think it's very clear that the preparation has been made. The legal arguments are absolutely in his favor, I believe. And what would likely happen is you would appeal it to the circuit court. And then it would just kind of go up from there. You know, you think about Virginia was the place where the case came out of Gloucester. GV versus that school board, and that was another transgender issue, went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. So somehow we've become a hotbed for these things. And interestingly enough, it's sort of these rural areas in Virginia where these things are kind of coming home to roost. But what we need to know is that Equality Virginia, the leading organization, LGBT interest group here in Virginia, their reaction to this story was, that's why we need statewide policy. So let's be clear that their reaction to a vague policy that's resulting in termination and an unwillingness for the school board to yield to someone's faith is let's do this in every community.
They want it codified in Richmond.
Absolutely, and we'll be dealing with that come January.
Well, I appreciate your work all year long and that of your organization. Take this last moment to tell folks how you can use their help. I appreciated you closed your column by calling for prayer for this dear man and his family during this troubled time. But also Family Foundation for folks in Virginia especially, but others listening who may want to, at the end of this year, kind of come alongside you. How can they help?
Absolutely. Our website's the easiest way to connect with us, familyfoundation.org. And that's a place where you can absolutely contribute to our work financially if you can. And we'll certainly be using that to stand alongside this teacher as he, you know, takes this battle, we hope, all the way to the Supreme Court.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
many Christians are ashamed they're depressed. They believe that only good Christians are happy and contented Christians.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Kevin McCullough. The holidays are a magical time, especially if you have children. The trees, lights, the presents, and if you're lucky, a little snow to create a picture-perfect setting. For a lonely person, this works in reverse. It becomes tragically dark for some. Dr. Gary Lovejoy is a professor and counselor who has written a number of books on depression. He joined Let's Talk with Mark Elstrand in Chicago, Illinois.
Okay, so we're in the month of December, and everybody likes to have that, you know, that, hey, that Merry Christmas feeling. But there's a reality here that there's a lot of people you might say that to, but they're not feeling very merry, and they're not even sure they're going to make it through the holidays. How often do you see that kind of condition exist around this time of year?
The depression itself is magnified, I think, at this time of year for a number of reasons. One is that it's a festive time of year. It's a family time of year. And when people are depressed and they feel alone, or they feel disconsolate, they may have marital problems. They may, and oftentimes marital stress increases during the holiday season. And they see the contrast between their own lives as they experience it and the despair they are feeling with the gaiety of the festive situation and people celebrating the nature of Christmas.
You know, I'm wondering also if there aren't just, you know, certain people that are more susceptible to dealing with this. I'm thinking in particular of those who have maybe lost loved ones or have gone through a divorce in the last several months, gone through some kind of personal trauma, and now they're coming up to this time of year, and they're just wondering, you know, how am I going to deal with this? Give me your thoughts on that.
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. Many of them have gone through bad experiences and have still processing. And like you say, it could be a divorce, it could be the death of a loved one. And sometimes those are called anniversary depressions because they mark the time when they've had a significant loss in their life. And so they're reminded of that, and that sends them spiraling downward. There can also be, as you say, whether it's a divorce or whether usually around Christmas time, then there's the stress of trying to work the arrangement with the children and who's going to be with the children on Christmas Day and Christmas Eve and all the rest. And so there's a lot of complications that are introduced by those sorts of things. But certainly the fact that some people have long-term depression, they've been depressed maybe most of their lives. When I speak at a group, for example, I may speak at church, for example, and probably half the people I'm looking at are probably experiencing some level of depression.
Wow.
Sort of another. And depression is extremely widespread. And especially among Christians, many Christians are ashamed they're depressed. They believe that that only good Christians are happy and contented Christians. And that somehow they failed God, they've disappointed him, and that they couldn't use him any further because they're depressed. But nothing could really be further from the truth when we believe that. The interesting thing is that depression and anxiety are the two most common emotional disorders discussed in the Bible. Most people aren't aware of that. Depression is no stranger to the Bible, and yet you might ask yourself the question, when was the last time you heard a sermon on depression? Probably, in my lifetime, I probably only heard maybe less than half a dozen. And part of the reason for that is that depression among pastors is also very high.
Hmm.
Most studies show that about 70% of pastors are struggling with some level of depression.
Hmm.
Those are startling statistics. And so it may be one reason that they don't hear it very often from the pulpit is because they themselves are struggling with depression, and they may feel like, as a pastor, I should be the paragon of emotional health, and here I am struggling with depression. And so a lot of people have stereotypes about depression and feel ashamed of it. But God can use us, even in our most difficult times. He can use us in mighty ways, as he did his servants in the Old Testament,
in the
process of redemptive history.
So what should we be on the lookout for in terms of friends or relatives or coworkers who might be giving us some symptoms, some tips here, and how can we be of help?
Well, if you know, depression sometimes is misunderstood. Some people don't recognize some of the symptoms of depression. I mean, obviously, if they're sad and feeling empty and worthless and inadequate and helpless and hopeless, it's pretty obvious they're depressed. But many of them have just simply lost interest and pleasure in many of the activities they engaged in before. They may show signs of social withdrawal, and they may be struggling with insomnia, either difficulty getting to sleep or staying asleep. Or sometimes they even have just the opposite, hypersomnia, where they're sleeping all the time. Or you might see them having a loss of appetite, or just the opposite there. It could be compulsive eating, binge eating. Sometimes they have excessive feelings of guilt. Most of it's false guilt, or feelings of inefficiency. They're indecisive. They lack concentration. But very often we encounter it in terms of the anxiety. They feel anxiety, sometimes intense anxiety, which is a common component of depression. And they also have various physical symptoms like body aches and pains. They may be slowed in their speech and hanging and slow body movements. Among men especially, there can be outbursts of anger and increased irritability, blaming other people, exaggerated sense of frustration. These are all symptoms. In fact, some people think, oh, well, they've got anger management problems, and they pass it off as that. But in fact, oftentimes they have a much deeper level, have a depression problem. And so, but they don't get treated for the depression. They deal with the symptom, which is the anger. And so some of these people are experiencing oftentimes intense anger, not only at others, but sometimes at themselves. There's a lot of self-hatred and self-loathing involved in that.
So if one of our listeners is, having a sense that, you know, there's added anxiety, or they're experiencing symptoms of depression or even stress, rather than just, kind of allow that to kind of process through, how can they be proactive to do something about this?
About 70% of the people who struggle with depression never seek help of any kind,
wow,
whether it's from antidepressant medication or whether it's counseling or any other professional treatment. They don't seek any treatment. They just bear up under it. In fact, many people see the world in kind of gray tones. You know, this is as good as it gets. It doesn't get any better than this. In fact, there was a line in that movie, As Good As It Gets. It was the title of the movie, starring Jack Nicholson, where he was had OCD and so forth. And he comes out of the psychiatrist's office and he looks around at all the people in the waiting office and says, "Have you ever really thought that this is as good as it gets?" In other words, there's that kind of hopelessness that the gray world is all you can really expect in life, but you can expect far more than that. And God provides for us that opportunity to expect more from life than that. But if they are experiencing these things, I would really encourage them to seek the help that they need. Some people feel like, well, I can't, nothing's going to get better. Counseling's not going to help me. For men, oftentimes they don't want to hang their dirty linen in front of a stranger, so therefore they don't want to go in. And women more often show up in the counseling room than men do. But still, the question is, do you need help? Have you concluded that this is the best life has to offer, that life will never be better than simply gray? And that is simply not the case. So I would encourage them, and if they don't know of anyone, they can always go to their primary care physician, most of whom they have some level of trust, and ask them for a referral to people that they know. But to avoid getting the help you need when help is clearly available is one of the great tragedies of depression.
To hear the rest of this conversation, including answers on how to handle depression during the holidays, go to ChristianOutlook.com. I'd like to talk to you for a moment about ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack. But if you act now, you can protect your family today and for generations to come. Go to ChristianOutlook.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up,
just how much must you apologize in order to be considered adequately now contrite?
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. It used to be you make dumb mistakes when you are young, you grow out of them, and then you move on. But the left does not forgive so easily. Take the case of Kevin Hart, recently slated to host the Academy Awards. Here's Dr. Albert Mohler from his daily briefing program.
We found out Kevin Hart had been given an ultimatum by the Academy, either apologize urgently, immediately, and in their view, adequately, or step down. He stated, quote, "I passed on the apology. The reason why I passed is because I've addressed this several times. This is not the first time this has come up. I've addressed it. I've spoken on it. I've said where the rights and wrongs were. I've said who I am now versus who I was then. I've done it. I'm not going to continue to go back and tap the days of old when I've moved on and I'm in a completely different space in my life. The same energy that went into finding those old tweets could be the same energy put into finding the response to the questions that have been asked years after years after years. We're feeding the internet trolls and we reward them. I'm not going to do it, man. I'm going to be me and stand my ground," end quote. But this raises a very interesting question. In this case, it's for the left in our culture, not so much for the right. Just how much must you apologize in order to be considered adequately now contrite before the altar of public opinion to be able to do something like host the Oscars? The answer is, we don't know the answer. But just like what we are seeing in so much of society, It's a march further and further to the left. Now, that's not to say that Kevin Hart didn't make statements for which he is almost assuredly embarrassed. But it is to say that we're not here having a serious conversation about the moral content of his tweets. We're instead simply looking at virtue signaling all the way through our society. Right down, you might say, most excruciatingly but predictably on the stage of the Oscars. It's very important to recognize that Susan Fowler, an editor at the New York Times, wrote a piece in which she called for forgiveness for Kevin Hart. She said this, quote, "I'm not condoning Kevin Hart's old jokes, and he isn't either, but I fear we're creating a disastrous precedent in holding people accountable for their old views, even ones they realized were wrong and apologized for. We are setting standards that nobody can meet. We cannot expect to make progress if we do not allow people the chance to grow with us," end quote. Now, that might appear to be very open-minded, but understand what that argument really amounts to. Yes, we can tell you exactly how the issue has evolved, and we can order you to evolve in exactly this way. If you do evolve that way, then we will absolve you of what you have said in the past, according to this logic. But you must, in the present and certainly in the future, accept everything we demand as the acceptable, the only acceptable moral position for now. You might call that right now the near left position. The far left, or the further left position, was taken by an editorial piece in the Washington Post by Nicole Mason. She wrote, here's the headline, "He won't be hosting the Oscars after his homophobic jokes resurfaced, but he'll be fine." She writes, quote, "Those who have called Hart to account have cut short his dreams of hosting the Oscars, and he may now be forever labeled a homophobe. What future opportunities might he lose because of this witch hunt?" Witch hunt put in quotation marks. She says the answer is, who cares? He, like many famous men who have gotten into trouble for offenses ranging from clueless remarks to criminal accusations, will be just fine. She concludes, "We have a duty and a moral obligation to protect and defend the most vulnerable among us. When those in positions of power commit acts or use words that are racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic, or sexist, they must be held accountable. When they are not and given platforms on the national stage, the message it sends to those with the least amount of power in society is that who they are doesn't matter, and neither do their lives or experiences," end quote. I simply want us to note the logic here. This is very much, in the case of the article and the controversy behind it, it is very much like the kind of Soviet demands for ideological conformity that marked the Cold War. There had to be public apologies, public contrition for ever holding a position that was in violation of party doctrine. And now you see something hauntingly familiar here. And you're seeing it amongst people who do not even put a limitation on the argument they are making. Just how far are those who are making this argument willing to take this logic? If you take the article at face value, there's no limitation on this whatsoever. There's a basic inconsistency here. This principle, even on this very issue, if applied across entertainment, would mean that an awful lot of the people who are actually going to be standing on that stage and sitting in that audience would be similarly excised. But this is a very selective effort. Now, you might say, well, it's not so selective when you consider that the man was invited to host the Academy Awards. Yes, well, let's just say that's true. But if you really see this as such a bedrock issue, a principle, then you can't stop just with the host. You're going to have to go down all the way to the guests as well.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, a pro-life black man is harassed by the city of Oakland.
That made it illegal for me to stand on a public sidewalk holding a sign, passing out literature, like to a pregnancy care center, and have a conversation. It was just outrageous.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Kevin McCullough. The book Black and Pro-Life in America tells the tale of Walter Hoy, a man who has risked everything to save the lives of the unborn. But in his hometown of Oakland, he is unwelcome. Frank Sontag spoke with Hoy on KKLA in Los Angeles.
Let's set this up a little bit. You're a man that loves the Lord. The book is called Black and Pro-Life in America. What sidewalks are we talking about where you would stand there and well, let's get into the story.
The story is the city of Oakland created a law to stop me from helping women in front of an abortion clinic. Literally, I was standing on this public sidewalk in front of an abortion clinic holding a sign. Frank, the sign said, God loves you and your baby, let us help you. And the women would read the sign, and literally they'd ask me, is it true that God loves me? Is it true that he loves me and my baby? And if it's really true, would you help me? And in every case, I did. And so that got to be such a problem that the city of Oakland created a law, an ordinance, that made it illegal for me to stand on a public sidewalk holding a sign, passing out literature, like to a pregnancy care center, and have a conversation. It was just outrageous.
Two men on the radio talking about the importance of life, and yet we live in a time in a country where a large majority of the population does not comprehend what's going on behind closed doors as it applies to this topic.
Oftentimes, when I was on the sidewalk, the men would also be walking with the women. And I remember this one time, Frank, this one time, they pulled up. You know, I slowly walked over. The young lady said that she didn't want to talk about it. She walked right on into the clinic, although she was really hesitant and she had her head down. She really didn't want to go. But the man was standing there putting money into the meter. Well, I went over to the man, and I was ready to have a serious conversation with him. But he looked up to me, Frank, and said, hey, man, I know you're right. I said, what do you mean you know I'm right? He said, man, I know you're right. Abortion is going to take the life of my child. I said, well, man, what are you doing? Go get her and let's save the life of your child. He said, I can't. I said, well, what do you mean you can't? He says, I'm no longer a man. He had been doing this for so long, between, I believe it was 16 and 26, he had like, 14 children, something like that. And 12 of them, Frank, were no longer with us. And the only two that were left alive were the ones that had, their mothers had restraining orders against him. He said he was less than a man. He said he was just a dog now. And at that point, I began to realize that you've got to minister to the men as well. And I literally, right there, began to minister to his heart.
Walter, if you would, I want to go back to that time in Oakland where you stood outside of a family planning specialist abortion clinic with a sign, God loves you and your baby, let us help you. What happened that day?
Well, I was literally there, and that day wasn't particularly busy, the day I was arrested. But I noticed that all of the clinic escorts, you know, they were wearing these orange vests. Instead of following me like they normally do, they'd follow me, block my sign. They would try to interrupt our conversation. They would take the literature I'd hand out to the women. They were all standing, and they were all crowded in front of the door. And I didn't have any understanding why they were doing that. I was just glad they weren't following me. Was it turns out the police drove up, and they got out. They ran over to the clinic door, and they started to arrest the abortion clinic escort. They were blocking the walkway, and they said, "Oh no, not us, get him." And then they pointed at me, and then the police put their head down. They walked over to me and began to ask me, did I know about the ordinance? I did. No, I wasn't blocking the sign. No, I wasn't preventing women from going into the clinic. Yes, the women were voluntarily having conversation with me. But they knew that this was an unjust law. And while they didn't want to do it, they did. They turned me around. They handcuffed me. and they stuffed me in the back of the police car. Now, Frankie, you know that when they put you in the back of the police car, they put their hand on the top of your head to kind of push you down to make sure you don't hit your head as you're going into the back seat. Well, the guy did that. The police did that. And he looked at my hat, that God Jesus hat. And he said, you know, your hat even violates the law. Because Jesus has a tendency to discourage women from having abortions. Mm. At that point, Frank, I've been wearing a hat ever since.
Did the thought go through your mind that you may run the risk of being arrested?
No, not at all. I just couldn't imagine that in the city of Oakland, you got a preacher on the sidewalk that's buying groceries, that get them a place to stay, that's taking them on, that's literally helping people. As a matter of fact, the police had come several times, but before they had passed the law, they really didn't want to come. There was nothing they could do about it, and there was nothing they wanted to do about it. There were much more serious crimes going on in the city of Oakland than a preacher literally out buying food and helping people. So, no, I never, ever thought that I would ever be arrested. But I tell you, it got real clear when I got in court. We had a jury trial, and by the time I'm in the middle of the trial, it becomes really clear that no matter what, even with videotape evidence, that the only woman complaining about me was the executive director of the abortion clinic. Not one woman that was a patient going into the clinic had anything to say. All the women I was helping, I helped. It was only the executive director who had anything against me. And it just so happened, we had videotaped evidence that she was lying in court, and we played it. And after I played it, yeah, while they admitted that her testimony was impeached, they didn't care. They allowed her impeached testimony to be used in their closing arguments.
For the entire conversation between Sontag and Hoy, go to ChristianOutlook.com. You've seen how your freedom is under attack. But if you act now, you can protect your family today and for generations to come. Go to ChristianOutlook.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up,
here again is the liberal left trying to dictate everything you do.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. You may have noticed a slew of articles telling us two things. One, the planet is doomed if we don't stop global warming now. And two, cows are causing a lot of the global warming. Enter the vegans, who are smiling as the far left pushes a meatless world. CNN even coughed up an article this week suggesting we replace hamburgers with insects. I kid you not. Wait till you hear how they responded in Los Angeles. Here's Bob Burney, host of Bob Burney Live on The Word in Columbus, Ohio.
LA City Council is planning on taking some radical action again. Now, in spite of the enormous problems they have in Los Angeles, listen to this. Vegans have been striking back against their carnivorous overlords in big ways recently. The Los Angeles City Council is now considering legislation that would force public venues in Los Angeles to sell vegan food. Yeah, it will be a mandate. And of course, here again is the liberal left trying to dictate everything you do, every place you go, everything you do, everything you eat. Big brother government wants to have a hand in it. And I say this advisedly, I say it carefully, I say it compassionately, but I say it truthfully. The loony left has gotten a hold of the Los Angeles City Council, and they are seriously considering a mandate legislation that would mandate vegan options be made available in public spaces, such as all large-scale entertainment venues, all airport terminals, all sports stadiums, all movie theaters. The proprietors, the owners of the restaurants, the kiosks, and so forth, would be required to put vegan dishes on their menu. Councilman Paul Koretz told reporters inspiration for the law stemmed from the rising number of vegans in Los Angeles and, of course, climate change. Say what? Yeah. And here's a quote from Councilman Paul Koretz in Los Angeles. We only have a few years to dramatically drop our greenhouse gas production and production of beef items, especially, generates so much methane, bovine flatulence.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. For executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards and David Posehn, and Mike Cook, I'm Calvin McCullough. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.